We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
The nice thing about using the program that I'm using to host this little podcast is I get a little map of the United States, or actually the whole world, and it colors in like the states that we have at least one listener in. And we so far have 22 states and 14 countries. And there's one guy or girl from Kentucky. So, you know, that I don't know how that happened, but I basically imagine like this beautiful girl sitting alone, you know, reading, I don't know, Hemingway.
Listening to your voice.
Yeah.
Talk about Louis Zambarelli.
Yeah. with a glass of, what's a nice cognac? I don't know. Anyway, it's probably actually somebody who's a fan of looking for the Josh Vogel, the bodybuilder. And we're really upset.
16-year-old teen bodybuilding success. Well, yeah. You know what? He might be 17, though.
So he's almost legal age, ladies.
Pretty much. But that smile was legal years ago. There's also a country singer, Josh Vogel, in case you guys were wondering what other iterations of me there are out there.
Who's the most popular Josh Vogel? If you Google Josh Vogel, who are you going to get?
I mean, I think on YouTube, I probably have the most videos up because there's only so many muscles you can flex. And there's only so many country songs you can write. There's also, I think, a woodworker in upstate New York, Josh Vogel, who is quite popular as well. But I think I might be the most interesting one.
Yeah, but are you in the top? Are you the number one when you type in Josh Vogel on Google?
I don't know. Let's find out. Using
technology.
Advanced technology.
Computer.
Computer. Search. All right, Josh Vogel. Josh Vogel art. My blog pops up, and then three pictures of the bodybuilder, and one picture of the
woodworking guy.
The woodworking guy, yeah, from Black Creek Mercantile and Trading Company.
Man, it's a close race.
It is. My blog's on the very top, though, but then I'm not really mentioned.
No big deal. Whatever.
All after that,
number one. So last time we actually talked, you and I talked about this guy Louis Zamperini. And what I kind of realized is, you know, I read the book Unbroken about him. I read a bunch of stuff about him. And as I, in my broken English, tried to explain why this guy is amazing, I realized how difficult it is to capture a man's life in just a few words, you know? And I sounded like an idiot, which will be a theme throughout this podcast, really. But, you know, as we try to talk about these people, there's no way we can really capture these extraordinary minds and lives in a few sentences.
Unless you're on Twitter.
We need to keep it down to
140 characters or less.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm not on Twitter, because that's a lot of pressure. You have to perform in such short time.
You're on Twitter.
No, I'm not see, that's something you say when you're not popular somewhere, is you say, I'm not there. When
you realize having your own podcast is going to catapult your Twitter stardom to...
Yeah, these dozens. That girl from Kentucky, that beautiful, beautiful woman. So, because I have all these notes, I'm going to look down a lot and try to think of the...
They can hear you looking down.
The silence is deafening. So the guy that I want to talk to you about this week is a guy by the name of Dean Karnazes, that a lot of people might know now because I think he was in the, like, top 50 sexiest male athletes of 2004, which is probably why you would know him, Josh.
Yeah.
I know it's a while ago, but you're a big fan of those journals. But
I got nothing to say.
He's an ultramarathon runner, and what that is you run a really long time. The marathon is 26 miles, and ultra marathon is anything over 26 miles. So he, just some accomplishments about him. And first of all, go get his book, Ultra Marathon Man. It'll inspire the shit out of you. But he has completed what's considered to be the toughest race on earth. It's the Badwater Ultra Marathon. That's 135 miles in 120 degree heat. It gets up to 160 degrees, the road does. He ran 350 miles straight, which is the longest distance anyone has ever run without stopping. It took him 80 hours and 44 minutes. He has run 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 days. And he's written a book about it called 50-50, which, as the top Amazon review says, the book is exactly as the title says. It's 50-50. There's a lot of negative reviews, in other words.
That's pretty clever. I like that.
Yeah, it's pretty clever. I thought he got a lot of likes for that. He was really proud of himself. And he mountain biked for 24 hours. Basically, there's a list of accomplishments that make you feel like a lazy ass is what this does. And his next plan is to run a marathon in all the countries in the world, straight.
You got to ask yourself, what is he running from?
That's actually you're like the clever Amazon reviewer, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm like the guy who writes the Amazon reviews of the T-shirt with the three howling wolves.
Yeah, like the Amazon reviews for, I think there's like a multi-million dollar painting that. It's put up on Amazon.
Oh, yeah, it was like a Monet or something.
Yeah, Monet, yeah. All these reviews for it. It's funny, not that I want to take your brilliant humor and say something very depressing, but I will.
Don't dull my shine.
I am going to. I'm about to. In fact, a lot of great athletes, including this guy, have suffered some sort of tragedy in their life that has launched them. So, in a sense, he always says that he is, in fact, running from something because his sister died in a car accident when he was younger. So it's a similar theme as with like Dan Gable, where his sister got raped and murdered in their own houses when he was younger. So now tragedy breeds, like, I don't know what it breeds, but something in your mind just snaps where you you almost want to escape whatever the difficult feeling of that is by taking on challenges that basically overwhelm you, that take up your whole life. It's like a passion, a singular passion that you're just obsessed with.
Yeah, it's like they have a lot of pain to burn off.
I'm trying not to laugh at that comment.
That was my only serious comment on this podcast ever. And
but it sounded like you're talking about calories. So
it's, yeah, that's how I think about it.
It made me imagine like a meter where it shows the calories and the amount of pain you've burned.
Yeah, it's like a pain burger.
Yes, so there's a lot of things I could say about this guy, but it's really, as a lot of people that run know, that running is basically a popular form of suffering, where whatever distance you choose, if you're looking to sort of better your time every time you're trying to improve, you're basically getting better at suffering. You're dealing with a really difficult, like, everything is burning, everything is hurting, but you're just shutting that off. And what the ultramarathon is you're basically really good at suffering for long periods of time. But he discusses, now he gives an example of karate, I don't know why, and it's really annoying to me, but as an example of a sport where the suffering is in short bursts. So, but I think of jiu-jitsu in that similar sense as, sports like wrestling and stuff. When I say suffering, it sounds dramatic, but really just putting your body into this state where there's intense cardio, and you're trying to shut that off and focus on the task at hand. No, Josh and I just got done training, actually.
For hours.
Hours, yes. And his advice is really get good at saying one more. You know, whenever you're... it applies at the bar with drinks, with girls, but it also applies in training where you say just, you know, whenever you're tired, at any one moment, just get really good at saying, you know, I'm not done, I just do one more. And he says that kind of process is what gets me through running, 350 miles straight. Is you just always say, well, why the hell not? I'll just do one more.
Yeah, but I got places to be, Lex. I got to get out of here.
Yeah, you keep looking at your watch. It's weird. And you don't even have a watch.
Exactly.
We talked about last time that you're learning French, and I really couldn't pass up the opportunity to make fun of you for picking a language that's the least masculine of all of them.
Well, I'm learning Japanese too, though.
Oh, God damn it. So you're balancing it out. That's good.
Exactly.
How's that going?
I've been trying to learn Japanese for like a year and a half on and off. I'm not super committed to it. It's just like a hobby. The French I've only been trying to learn for maybe like a month and a half now. So far so good. I mean, I find that I can't do both. Like, if I try to, like, my wife, for example, she's learning French and German right now. And she learned French in high school, so it's a little bit easy. She's got a background in it. But we're both finding that it's very difficult to switch. Like, I can't listen to my French tapes and then go listen to the Japanese tapes and be able to keep any of it in my head. Like, it's...
Is it because they were on the opposite sides of World War II, or is
yeah, more just because... I think part of it's just, I mean, the sentence structure is different, but then also, like,
yes,
one thing that my wife and I were talking about is just, like, maybe, like, the rhythm of the languages is different. So it's kind of like trying to, like, when I teach the MoveNet classes, I would have people do this exercise where they would sprint across the mat, and then they would have to slowly balance across a balancing beam. And a lot of people had trouble with that because they're going from a super intense activity to a slower, more controlled activity involving balance.
Yeah, by the way, I'm going to interrupt you rudely. Can you tell me about MoveNet really quick?
Sure.
In case people don't know what the hell it is.
In French?
No.
So MoveNet...
Uh-huh.
that's Lex's French.
Yeah, that's as good as I got.
MoveNet is basically a system of physical education. And the easiest way to put it is... It's sort of like CrossFit. Like, you know how CrossFit has focuses on different disciplines? Like, you know, you do Olympic lifting, you do some things from gymnastics, you do jumping. It's basically like a mix of different sports. It's got that element to it, where, like, but it's not really mixing different sports. It's more like you're practicing things like running, jumping, crawling, climbing, lifting and carrying heavy things, and you're trying to do this in, like, keeping a practical context in mind. So, for example, you could do pull-ups, if you're looking at it from a MoveNet perspective, a pull-up is just a part of a climbing motion. So when you do a pull-up, why are you doing a pull-up? You're doing it so you can pull yourself up on top of something so you can climb it. So if I'm trying to climb a tree, I would jump up, grab a branch, do a pull-up until my chest is about level with the branch, and then I would do another maneuver to get myself on top of the branch, maybe like a muscle-up or something a little bit more efficient that's easier to get up. And then once I'm on top of the branch, I would have to balance if I wanted to walk along the branch or crawl.
Right, so the idea is that as you're doing these movements in MoveNet, you're kind of visualizing the same thing to make it give a kind of a practical context for your brain. So
it's like we were talking about in jiu-jitsu earlier, like those guys that are like, well, that wouldn't work in a real fight, bro. Like, if I was doing this in, like, if I was tailgating and some guy started some shit with me,
nunchucks, you can't fuck with nunchucks.
Yeah, so it's like that, but, like, you know, like, if I'm gonna pick something heavy up, right? So if I'm gonna do deadlifts, why am I doing a deadlift? I can do that deadlifts in the gym to strengthen certain muscle groups, or you can think about it as a practical movement. I deadlift something so that I can put it
like
onto my lap.
One of those big ass TVs.
Yeah,
that used to have. Yeah.
Like when I worked at the moving company, for example, like you never just deadlift something at a moving company. You pick it up, you carry it down a flight of stairs, up a flight of stairs.
Unless you're carrying like a dumbbell up or down the flight of stairs, because, you know, you still have to move that equipment as well.
Correct. Exactly.
Like an Olympic bench, you have to move it.
And then it becomes like a riddle within a riddle within a riddle.
Yeah,
like,
within a riddle.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so that's you know.
Did that somehow relate to learning languages? It did. What, I don't even remember.
It did.
anyway, you're learning French and Japanese, which, by the way, are the two top countries for judo. So that's another interesting thing.
Well, that's part of why I chose both of those languages, because if I were going to learn something like, I don't know, Ukrainian... I don't know if that's even a language. I mean, I assume that...
Well, that's actually a good one, too, for judo.
So if I wanted to learn, like, Klingon, right? They don't, you know, like, it's not a language that people on Earth speak. I don't know if they have judo on Klingon. but, like, I'm interested in, like hand balancing stuff. I like judo. And so...
So you can go on like, the French forums and talk shit to them.
Exactly.
About judo and say they don't know anything and jiu-jitsu is better.
Yeah, so it gives me a context. Like, instead of just trying to learn a language that I have nobody to speak to and nothing interesting to learn about, I can talk to people in French, or I can try to speak to people in Japanese about, you know, judo, or I can watch a judo video in Japanese and try and pick apart, you know.
That's actually really cool because there's a lot of good instructional videos in Japanese.
Yeah, Kashiwazaki has some good videos on YouTube.
Have you ever considered learning Portuguese?
You know, it's funny, like, I as a Brazilian jiu-jitsu instructor, you would think that I would learn Portuguese, but for some reason, I just haven't really gotten into it. I mean, the French is easy because my wife speaks a certain amount of French, so she can help me along, and then we can speak it at home. And then my friend that I train with here, Will, he speaks French as well because he's from France, so he can, you know, try hard not to laugh at my poor French.
No, I mean, so just so you know, my parents were going to move to France. So I actually, it's embarrassing to say, but I actually learned French for maybe like 7 to 8 years. It's embarrassing to say because what you heard of my French earlier is really what I still got. But it's one of the things that I think...
Spoken beautifully, though.
Yeah. It's like... and my appreciation of the movie Ratatouille is really the two French things I have. No, but it's funny how that slips away. So the last time was maybe 14 years ago. But I'm sure it's somewhere... You know, I wonder that about languages. I'm sure it's sitting in the back of my brain somewhere. And if I actually wanted to... like learn it would be a quick process.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, that cliche about riding a bike. I mean, I don't know, I've never had that same experience as you, like growing up learning a different language and then not speaking it for a long time, but I imagine it would probably, like, you know, you just add water and it reactivates.
Yeah, that's it. You mentioned your wife speaking French, and so I dated a French girl for a while, like an actual French girl from France. That meaning, like, she's fluent, easily fluent in French, and we had almost zero conversations in French because she didn't like. She wasn't. People that are good at French don't want to. Like, it just was. It seemed like work.
I gotcha.
Speaking French with me is like she's being a teacher, and like just listening. Because what happens is you're not at all clever. Because my English, I'm. You know, you can say clever shit, like, you can swear, but in French...
Right, that's what she said, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Like clever stuff.
But you can't have that same kind of level of wit in another language, so I was always upset. And the same thing with my parents, you know, they were always upset with me that I didn't want to speak English with them in the house. You know, when I come back from school and stuff, when we moved to America... It's because it was totally, because it was hard work for me to speak English with them because their English sucked at that time.
I gotcha.
It was good, but it had lacked the wit, the humor, the natural kind of flow of that makes talking actually fun.
I mean, I think it helps that, you know, Angie is trying to relearn French herself,
well.
So we're learning simultaneously. Whereas, like, you know, my friend Will, like. I try not to impose on him too much because he, you know, he's from France. He speaks it fluently, but I don't want to be that guy that's like, "Hey, Will, bonjour," you know, like, you know, and then he's got to correct me every 3 seconds. And like, I don't want it to be like a job for him. I just want to, like, you know, if I say something every once in a while, he's very gracious about helping me with it, but I try not to overdo it with him. So I can see what you're saying.
What do you find has been the most effective way of learning Japanese or French? So there's kind of two schools of thought, which is one is you kind of approach it with a drilling mindset of, like, you have very specific, you kind of go by the book and, like, learn the grammar rules and the structure of language, learn the words, or you just immerse yourself. The other school is you watch French TV, you know, you listen to podcasts in French, you listen to audiobooks in French, you, like, try to talk to French people. So those are, like, the two...
That's pretty much, like, that's a good point that you bring up. Like, so I approach it the same way I try to approach jiu-jitsu. I'm using these Michelle Thomas tapes. Like, he's I guess he's dead now, but he was a language instructor for many years, and language instructor to the stars. And he put out this excellent series of tapes using a very specific method. And some of his older tapes are, like, you know, French, English, Spanish, things like that. And then some of the newer ones are done by different people using his method. And so I listen to those tapes because they provide me with the basic skeleton of the language. They focus a lot on explaining how verbs work, how the sentence structure works. Like with Japanese, you know, the sentence structure is like, what is it, subject, object, verb, like the verb's at the end of the sentence, whereas in some other languages it would be subject, verb, object, or like there's just a different structure. So he'll basically lay out the skeleton of the language, and then I try to immerse myself in it a little bit too by, you know, watching judo videos in Japanese or listening to French music. Or, you know, I mentioned in the first podcast that I have this interest in handstands, and so I bought a book about how to do handstands
in French.
In French.
That's awesome.
So I read it at night, and I try and, you know, apply that, try to listen to French music just to get used to the rhythms of it. And to me, it's very similar to learning jiu-jitsu. Like, when you learn jiu-jitsu, in an ideal world, you would learn jiu-jitsu in a jiu-jitsu school, and your instructors would provide a systematic framework for you to understand the skeleton of the art. So you learn how the mount works, side mount, all that kind of stuff, and how those things relate to each other. And then when you immerse yourself in jiu-jitsu, you start to watch YouTube videos, you start to hang out with jiu-jitsu people, you start to, you know, you start to talk about daily hiva guard in mixed company, and you get weird looks from people, you know.
Yeah, of course there's different levels of immersion. I think a lot of people will testify that the best way to really learn French is really go to France for 3 months, you know, and like live there. And the same thing with jiu-jitsu immersion. You should disconnect yourself from all the sources of distraction and just like go to a camp. I know they have those kind of things for judo, like judo camps and stuff,
yeah,
and wrestling. But you basically really immerse yourself, and then it becomes your whole kind of life, and train 3 times a day, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's extreme, though. That's like if you're somebody who is dedicated, like, 100%. Like, you don't have anything else going on. Because for me, like, I'm a jiu-jitsu teacher. I can't, you know, I guess I could go to France, but my wife would be mad at me. And
you would also possibly go with your wife. I didn't suggest you should you should just disappear.
I know, I'm just kidding. But, you know, but there are other things that I'm interested in.
You weren't really kidding. You're just saying you're kidding because this is on a publicly available podcast.
No. No, Alex, no.
And that would be really cool if you could do like a jiu-jitsu instructor exchange program.
That'd be cool.
It's kind of, you know, some weird Japanese guy comes in here, doesn't speak any English, or he's trying to learn English.
It'd be great if he used like the same shitty jokes that I use in my classes.
Yeah, but nobody would find them funny.
Nobody finds my jokes funny either. They laugh, but it's just to be nice. Yeah.
But here they wouldn't even know what the right timing of the laughing is.
Exactly.
Laugh randomly. Yeah, there's actually a really good video of Koga. I don't know if you know who that is.
He did those Koga A New Wind videos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of about him. But he's one of those guys that doesn't do instructionals. But he was on a vacation in California, and he did a surprise seminar. I think it was a free one. He just kind of rolled into a dojo.
Dojo Storm, Koga Storm.
Koga Storm.
Yep.
And, you know, they recorded it, but it's in Japanese, so...
Yeah, I think part of that, like what we were talking about before about immersion, like, that's why having those Michelle Thomas tapes as a framework to back up all the other, like, listening to the music, watching the videos, really helps a lot, because watching like a jiu-jitsu video in Portuguese or a judo video in Japanese it's a very specific technical thing. So like if you just learn Japanese from watching judo videos, you're going to know how to, like, if you go to a noodle shop in Japan, all you're going to know how to do is tell them how to reap the leg, or like how to do like you know, like major hips, you know, like it's going to be a very specific technical language. You might not know how to order sushi or octopus, you know. So like it's just like in jiu-jitsu, when you learn, people always say learn the basics first, have a good foundation, you can't build a house without a, you know, like all that shit. It's true, you know. And it would be like trying to master the Barambolo before having an understanding of how the back position works. I'm rambling now, you know what I'm saying?
I already fell asleep like 5 minutes ago. I wasn't listening.
I saw your eyes fluttering.
Like, what's your goal with Japanese and French? Do you think it's there's a Is it learning for the sake of learning, or are you hoping to be able to maybe visit either one of these countries? Or because, like, it helps me in jiu-jitsu is to have, like, a tournament in mind, you know, like 6 months from now.
Right.
You know, like, I would like to compete at Pan Ams, for example, in whenever the hell it is, March, April. And you just kind of keep that in the back of your mind as a possibility. You're not sort of definitely doing it, but it's something you're thinking about.
It's like a goal that keeps you focused on learning.
Yeah. So do you have, isn't that hard without that? Or is it just...
No, I mean, I have many goals. Like one of my many goals is to be able to understand that hand balancing book in French. I mean, it's not the ultimate goal, but like...
It's the kind of little goals that... Or they're pretty challenging goals, but it's...
Yeah, it's something that'll keep me motivated and keep me focused. But like, ultimately, I don't really need to speak French or Japanese. You know, to me, it's... They're like these... the ultimate puzzle. Like, I always like doing puzzles and, like, playing chess and problem solving. And I think that, like, everything I do, I love jiu-jitsu. That's my main, you know, as far as, like, activities go, that's my favorite thing. And so everything else that I do with, like, the hand balancing and the learning languages and all this other stuff, like, they're nice diversions sometimes so that I don't think about jiu-jitsu, but they're all things that ultimately I do so that I can take something back to jiu-jitsu from it. So, like, I can learn how people teach languages, and then, you know, maybe I can teach a better jiu-jitsu private lesson using the language learning model that somebody uses. Or the process of learning how to do a handstand might teach me something about body alignment that I can take back to jiu-jitsu and have a better mount from it.
So, why would you say, do you have this kind of... passion for trying to broadly understand jiu-jitsu? So there's different ways to obsess about things, which is, or to, you know, I think obsess is probably a negative word. I mean, to have a passion about something. And I think out of many of the jiu-jitsu people I know, you're like the John Donahue of Philly. You kind of have this very deep understanding of a lot of principles of jiu-jitsu and a desire to further understand them and to go, you know, broad and deep as well. That's what she said. So
that's that wit, that English wit you've got.
The English, yes. I couldn't do that in French. I need to learn how to. But by the way, The Office is pretty fucking popular in France. So
yeah. So like, you mean as far as like, it's nice of you to say that about Mr. Donahue. Like that dude is like. You know, whatever I read of his or his interviews or, you know, the things that, like the book that he wrote, Mastering Jiu-Jitsu, those things are all very inspiring to me. I'm really a big fan of his, so it's nice to...
What is it? Is it a technique book or is it like a philosophy type?
It's probably 70% philosophy and 30% technique. So it's really good. It's an old book that he wrote with Henzo Gracie, maybe 2003, something like that. I think it was the first book in Jiu-Jitsu that I got, and... I think it's by far the best book. It doesn't have that much in the way of technique, but it very clearly explains why jiu-jitsu works and like what the point of it is.
So when did he... Was he a black belt at that point?
I think he was a black belt.
This genius?
This genius. I don't know. I mean, I don't know a lot about his life or like you know, when he got his black belt. Yeah. I mean, I've only... You know, I took one of his group classes in with James. We went to Henzo School in New York in like 2006 or something like that, and I enjoyed the class. And then, of course, I enjoyed the things that he writes and his interviews. And
I have a feeling, like, by the way, I was going on tangents all over the damn place, but I, you know, I nonstop hear that the reason a lot of these people that are longtime black belts now, the reason they started jiu-jitsu is because of Royce Gracie in the UFC. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fascinating to me that this singular event has created like thousands of killers on the mat and also jiu-jitsu masterminds. It's kind of amazing how...
That is kind of cool.
It's like...
Royce Gracie is what got me into jiu-jitsu. Yeah. My brother and I watched the old the VHS tapes of UFC 2, and I remember going, like, watching... him demolish everybody. And I was thinking to myself, damn, that Indian dude's fucking awesome at jiu-jitsu. And I had no idea he was Brazilian. I thought he was like, from India, and some sort of branch of wrestling, like karate,
like
wrestling.
Some kind. Yeah, karate wrestling. Yeah. So that's what planted the seed of like jiu-jitsu in your brain?
Yeah. Yeah. Me and my brother watching those.
So you're another one.
Yeah. Just another drone.
So you think jiu-jitsu would be where it is now without UFC? It's kind of interesting too.
Definitely not. But you know what's funny is I don't think there would be any way for it to be as popular and as mainstream. But it's not even a mainstream sport. Like, I think jiu-jitsu now is where skateboarding was in 1997. Like, I've been skateboarding my whole life. So one of the parallels that I see with jiu-jitsu is that when I started skateboarding, I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And that was in, in 1989 or 1990 or something like that. And
it was in the 50s, wasn't it?
Yeah, back. Yeah, I'm only 30.
Holy shit, isn't your birthday?
Tomorrow. I'm going to be 34 years old. Well, I'm going to be a crusty old piece of shit.
If you're listening to this, the birthday's today probably. Go on Josh's Facebook and tell him happy birthday. Say something mean.
Thanks, guys. You can say...
say something very clever like, hey, man, happy birthday, !! Which is what everybody says.
Happy birthday, bro.
I don't know enough variations on bro, dude, and brother. And
oh, there's Bradigliani. There's Brophistopheles. Brosidon.
Poseidon, that's a good one.
Yeah, me and Drew have mastered the texting back and forth, like bro, like
yeah, bros of.
But you had a question.
Skateboarding.
Oh yeah, skateboarding.
And when did the X Games start?
I think it was in the early 2002 or something.
That's
something.
When it got really, I guess, big, right?
Yeah, it got a lot bigger around then. But it was this. I'm only 34, so when I started. I can't even pretend I was one of people say I was one of the old school guys. Like, I came into it, after skateboarding had already been around for decades. But when I came into skateboarding, it was, these giant wheels, big fish looking skateboards, heavy, giant airwalks covered in rubber. And, but it was still kind of a little dirtbag kid activity. You and your friends get together, you look like a bunch of jerks. Like,
it was
skateboarding,
a professional sport.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't the kind of thing where, you see some kid jumping off a ramp and doing a high five move with with a Diet Coke in his hand. It wasn't really on TV except for, a movie here and there, that Christian Slater movie. They call it A Brother's Justice when they made the made for TV version, but it originally was Gleaming the Cube.
Was he a skater in that?
He was a skater in that, and
in True Romance too. Is he in True Romance?
I think so. I'm not too sure.
Well, he's with that chick and he kills everybody. That's a good love story.
Thrashin' was the other skateboarding movie.
Sounds 80s.
It was, yeah. Yeah, Thrashin'. That was with, Josh Brolin was in that. Before he got famous from other shit that he did. I don't know. But
look it up, people. Anyway, I was asking you about why the hell... as an example, let me give you an alternative. Dean Karnazes is, he is obsessed with seeing how far he can go with this very simple activity of running. How far can he run? So he runs... First, he did the impossible, which is the 130... 5 mile Badwater run. Then he did 250. Then he did 350 miles. Then he keeps pushing it farther and farther just to see where his limit is. And there's people like that that just obsess with this one singular goal of seeing what can make them break. And so I don't as much see that with you don't seem to have such an unhealthy relationship with jiu-jitsu. You're much more of a knowledge seeker. You want to study this, like I said, with Donahue. You want to understand the principles behind this sport. Is that something that, are you conscious of that? Is that something that you're passionate about?
Yeah, because it's...
a reason?
It's like you were asking before, there's not, with jiu-jitsu, I don't have an ultimate end goal that, I don't care about competitions that much. I don't care about,
But you do. You have competed a shit ton.
A fair amount. I mean, not compared. Like you compete more than I do laundry. Like, you know, like. But I've competed a fair amount. As
but
like
enough
a,
to like say enough to own a ton of IBJJF shirts.
Yeah, exactly.
For your closet.
Yeah, and to be upset about my checking account status.
Yeah. You always got those like stories of going to worlds and.
Yeah, I mean, I've had my fun like competing, and you know, it like I've enjoyed that part of jiu-jitsu. But it's not like an ultimate goal for me. Like, but I like jiu-jitsu because it satisfies everything that I want in an activity. Like, it's creative, it's artistic, it keeps me in good shape. It allows me to, you know, be strong, flexible, fast. It allows me to solve problems and be engaged mentally. And what we were talking about before about how I like to learn about hand balancing, and I like to learn about French, and I like to learn about Japanese, and I like to learn about rock climbing and all these other things and take it back to jiu-jitsu. I like to learn that stuff to take it back to jiu-jitsu, but jiu-jitsu also gives me a lens to learn that stuff. Like if I didn't have jiu-jitsu, I would have absolutely no interest in learning French, and I'd have absolutely no interest in learning Japanese, and I'd have no framework to understand that stuff. But because I have jiu-jitsu as my model of how to learn stuff, and as like it's almost like my house, and from my house I can go out and learn all the shit and bring it home. And you know, I think it sounds corny, I guess. You know, people say, oh, you know, jiu-jitsu is really about making yourself a better person. And, you know, right. But for me, I feel like it really, I feel like I'm much smarter than I would otherwise be.
Wow,
from jiu-jitsu.
You started from a really low point then. Yeah.
I mean,
you get like the most improved award. I got that in soccer in freshman year in high school.
Yeah, exactly.
It means you really sucked before and now you're better.
Yeah, most improved, and then best hair.
Best hair.
Yep.
That's not true at all. We have Steven Plyler, which is world-renowned hair.
That's true.
Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt.
He's got black belt hair. He had black belt hair when he was like a blue belt.
Yeah. And he's competed a lot as well, and as...
He's really good.
Well, the most... I mean, of course, you know, he's good, whatever. But the main point is nobody has messed up his hair in competition. His hair remains unmessed up.
You know, I think Cobrinha has a similar thing.
True.
Like, if you ever watch videos of him, that dude has unshakable... His hair has base.
Yeah.
Like, you can't break that base. The hair is just fucking solid, and it's not going anywhere.
That's his weakness. Just like, you know, do that motion where you just kind of mess up his hair.
Yeah.
Like, and that would just totally mentally get in his head.
Yeah, maybe it would just probably shift not his base off just enough. Like you try and barambolo him or something,
yeah,
and his hair is jacked a little bit to the left, and he just can't keep his base because it's off.
More likely, it's just going to piss him off, and he'll just submit you that much faster.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I'm not sure why I draw so many parallels between running and jiu-jitsu, but they certainly are, in the sense that, like Dean Karnazes says, that there's no money in running. You know, a lot of the, especially ultramarathon running. I mean, you know, you could say there's money in jiu-jitsu, but, you know, compared to any other kind of large sport, if you see the professional competitors in jiu-jitsu, they don't make much money.
I think it's like a mixed bag, though. Like, I don't know much about the world of running. I mean, I imagine there's money, like, at the top from, like, sponsorships and stuff like that. But I think, for example, with jiu-jitsu, I see the parallel between jiu-jitsu and skateboarding. When I started skateboarding, there was no money in skateboarding. It was a bunch of dirt bags hanging out behind the 7-Eleven, building ramps out of like whatever bullshit you found in the trash. And I found that, like, you know, obviously, like, jiu-jitsu, when I started in 2003, so it's not even that long ago. So don't worry, I'm not going to pretend like I'm some like old school guy or whatever. But, you know, it people always talk about when sports were young as like the good old days when, you know, people didn't care about money and they were doing it for the sport of it. And so what I'm seeing with jiu-jitsu, and also what happened with skateboarding, was, you know, you start off a bunch of dirtbag kids, and then all of a sudden it starts to get more popular. You see it a little bit on TV, and then more people start doing it, more people start wearing the airwalks, more, and then airwalks start sponsoring people, and then skateboarders get better, and then more people start skateboarding, and then it becomes super popular, and then the sport of skateboarding has evolved to the point where there's 7-year-old kids doing stuff that is would have seemed physically impossible that you can't even do in video games.
Right.
Now, and the same thing with jiu-jitsu. You look at, you know, there's blue belts and IBJJF tournaments that are professional competitors that would just absolutely murder me and a bunch of other, you know, black belts that aren't the same.
Yeah, training 3 times a day for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a definitely a positive thing. I guess what I was trying to say, it's good for there to be money in things, but it's not part of the language and the culture. Like, it's like you're not rolling around with gold chains and your Cadillac and saying it's all about the cash. Like, that's why I really like Olympic sports, like wrestling. You know, Olympic wrestling has been taken out from the 2020 Olympics unless they can get back in, and I really hope they do. But one of the things that I admire about wrestling is really the only people that do it, and it's really popular, but the only reason you would do it is for this Olympic glory. At the highest level after college, you're dedicating your whole life, you know.
Yeah, you're right. That is kind of cool. Like, there's not, it's not the kind of thing where, you know, you wrestle in high school and you're sitting there, like, thinking that it's not like basketball. Like, this is my chance to, you know, get, like, a $10 million a year contract. Right. Yeah.
I find there's kind of a distinction between there's sports that are kind of made for spectators and there's more sports that are made for you, for the practitioner. Running is certainly an example of a sport that's exceptionally popular for the practitioner and is not so much for the people watching it, except for track and the Olympics, I think, is the only time it's popular at all. And I think jiu-jitsu, frankly, is growing. It's getting more popular for the people that roll around, and still not very popular to watch. Even so, events like Mona Morris and stuff are coming out, but
that's a hard sell to. I mean, like, for spectators to watch jiu-jitsu.
Do you have non-jiu-jitsu friends that you have to show the like these videos to, or?
Honestly, I mean, people, I have a real hard time finding a video that I would want to show a non-jiu-jitsu friend. Like, because I could show them, like, Marcelo Garcia versus Shaolin. That's kind of a cool video to show. The arm drag, rolling, take the back, and then Shaolin goes unconscious. That kind of, like, you know, if people, but then also too, they're both wearing, like, you know, super tight shorts, and it's,
yeah,
you know, so I get, like, comment. Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to, like, show somebody who doesn't do jiu-jitsu a video of, like, a black belt match from the IBJJF Worlds, like the finals, right, where two people are not doing anything for 10 minutes, or...
It's not a combat sport, really. I think of it more as chess, so...
Yeah, so it's hard to, like... I wouldn't show them a video of chess to, you know... It's like, oh, you mean the piece goes there? Oh, okay. Yeah. And then you wait for 10 minutes, and then the other piece goes... Yeah.
Which is something we were talking about. I think of jiu-jitsu as chess, and in that sense, you know, I don't pursue... see it as something that helps your self-defense on the street, which it, you know, it does, and a lot of people show that it helps you in a street fight scenario or in MMA or whatever. But to me, jiu-jitsu is just this fun chess game, you know, this human chess game that I enjoy doing.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm pretty sure all the things I drill and work on, I would not use on the street, just because I would probably go into a Tank Abbott mode of, I don't know if you remember who that is.
Big Oh, I remember.
Yeah, I would just probably swing like a madman and tackle, you know, double leg and...
Frenzy rage,
yeah. Have you been in this... Have you ever had to use a jiu-jitsu technique in a street scenario?
The closest I've come is... I did prayer hands, like the self-defense stuff.
Yeah.
But I had a big bag of Vietnamese noodle soup in my hand, and I couldn't put it down because...
So you're just clasping this
bag. Well, yeah, I was basically, like, sandwiching the bag. Like, I had the bag up, like, in front, just in case the guy wanted to hit me.
Yeah.
And because I didn't want to put it down, and then he could have kicked me in the face or something.
Right.
But the guy, he just logic. Wanted some money or something, so it wasn't really a big deal. But, like...
What did he get the money, or did he...
No, I mean, like, not mugging. He was asking for money, like, okay. He wanted some change or something.
And then you slowly walked away when you saw a guy clasping a bag of noodles.
Yeah, raising a bag of noodles high above my head. No, I mean, you know, that's pretty much, like, the only times I've... Like, the thing with self-defense is that it's different for everybody. Like, my needs for self-defense are different than a bartender or a bouncer's needs are going to be. or somebody who, you know, is worried about getting carjacked or like a home invasion.
And a lot of it is probably also, you know, the confidence that sort of radiates from you when you're like walking around. Like the dude probably, you know, he might have considered fucking with you until he saw the bag of noodles and the way you raised it up and just the stance and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I get fucked with a lot, though. Like, I because I ride a real shitty bicycle, and I look like I look like an idiot the way I dress. Like, I'm always dressed in, like, you know, like board shorts that are always covered in sweat, and then
you're
I always have
a tourist surfer that came in from San Diego just like to roll on the Philly streets.
Yeah, like I think I'm a pretty non-threatening person, so like, you know, and so I get screwed with a lot, but. Like yesterday, I was riding my bike down Chestnut Street, and some guy was listening to some fucking terrible music. And I was riding my bike by, and I, you know, obviously I didn't say anything. It was four guys in a car, and you know, I passed them.
Excuse me, sir, your music is terrible.
Yeah, excuse me. Do you mind playing some Creedence Clearwater, perhaps? But then, you know, they drove past me on my bike, and one guy looked out the window and said, "Get the fuck out the road!" And then they drove off.
Oh wow!
And then
nice.
I kept on riding down the same street, and once we got to Old City, the two of the guys, the one guy that said something to me, and then the other guy jumped out of the car and ran into like an expensive restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I stopped on my bike for a second, and I thought, all right, what's the best thing to do here? And then I parked my bike for a second, and I thought about it. I said, you know what? What the fuck am I doing?
Yeah, it's not
I
want to
go get some
well.
Coffee. Yeah, this is there's no way, like... Okay, do I go in the restaurant? Do I double leg the guy and smash his face into some fucking oyster crackers?
Yeah.
Or do I, you know, wait until he comes out and then challenge, like, you know, say, okay, well, I want to fight both of you guys, but only one at a time. And there's some grass across the street so that we don't get all cut up rolling around, you know?
Like, I remember, you know, our instructor, Phil McLaris, I think a while ago, said that, you know, like, a fight is never over.
Yeah.
You know, you really... If you get into an altercation on the street, you better be ready for that fight to resume 2 weeks later.
Yeah,
when the guy sees you again, so you have to watch your back, and it's just not a pleasant experience.
No, you're right. That's a good point. That's why I like.
So you stood there on your bike, pondering this very point, and said,
"Yeah, just for a second." Then I was like, "Fuck it, I'm gonna get some coffee." So I went and got some coffee.
You know, that's an interesting thing as a bike rider in Philadelphia is you get to actually on both sides, the pedestrian. A bike rider or in a car, you get to ponder, like, you get in these situations where somebody almost runs you over, or you either you do something stupid or they do something stupid, and there's this kind of, you're both pissed off at each other for a brief moment, and you get to both respond in whichever way you would like to. You get this option of, like, I will be angry for the next 10 minutes, maybe I'll start a fight right now, or you just, you know, just let it float.
Well, you know what's funny about that is that, like, I get in a lot of, like, little angry exchanges, like,
yeah,
between...
Yeah, because you're the bike rider. That's usually the hardest job.
But I usually, like, smile and let it go because I know that being a bike rider, the driver of the car might do something that's really, like, asshole-ish for a second, but then a block later, I'm going to do something that's really stupid, too. Yeah. Like, they might run a red light and almost hit me in the car. Yeah. And then I might ride my bike up on the sidewalk and almost hit somebody on the sidewalk. Yeah. And so, like, I figure, okay, well, they were an asshole, but I'm probably going to be an asshole to somebody else. So
it's good that you see it that way because it does balance out. But sometimes it's hard to realize that in the moment when you're just pissed off.
I have one of those old, like, Schwinn girls' bikes.
You have, like, a... You have a basket and stuff.
Yep, I have a basket.
That's awesome.
And it's crooked because my bike gets knocked over so much that the basket's all, like, mangled and smush looking. It's always
Do you
got,
actually
like,
use the basket, or is it just for style?
Yeah. No, I put my gi in it after I'm done training, and I usually put my trash in it. Like, I'll have probably three or four empty cups of coffee in there at a time.
So you ride, like, a long time home, right? What is it, 20 miles?
No, it's
Jesus, wait, no, sorry.
It's like 6 miles.
20 minutes.
Yeah, it's like a 40-minute ride each way.
40-minute?
Yeah. But it's good because I get to ride through the city and I get to go through, like, Chinatown and Old City. And
this guy, Dean Karnazes, has done 24 hours on a bike.
That's a long bike ride.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I mean, the longest bike ride I've ever done is probably... My wife has a driver's license. I do not. And I love her dearly because she drives me around. Like, you know, she'll pick me up from work sometimes. Yeah. And so when
I'm
she
gonna
goes...
I'm going to edit that part somehow to make it sound like you're an asshole.
Nice.
That's the sweetest thing to say.
All thanks, right, Lex. And she's, you know, she was really gracious about driving me. And when she goes on vacation, I don't have that luxury. So when she goes on vacation to Disney, I ride my bike. Like, when I first moved to my new neighborhood, which was like 3 years ago, so it's not new, I enjoyed riding my bike back and forth. So I would ride my bike from my house to Balance, which is 40 minutes. And then during my lunch break, I would ride home 40 minutes, eat lunch, ride back 40 minutes, train at night, and then ride home for 40 minutes. So that is 160 minutes in one day of bike riding.
So you said, how many miles is it again?
It's like 6 miles each way.
Right.
So that's, what is it, 24 miles?
Yeah, so 24. Oh, that's impressive. So I try to, I'm trying to come up, you know, use this podcast actually as a way to motivate myself to do shit, like little things that I'm uncomfortable doing. For example, this weekend I'd like to compete in a catch wrestling tournament, which is something I didn't even know what that is. I thought that's something that UFC fighters say they do just because when they don't know what else to put.
Just to get on jiu-jitsu people's nerves.
Yeah, just to mess with them. Yeah, but it's an actual, you know, organization that's doing, that's hosting catch wrestling tournaments. And I like the idea of it because it's submission only, plus you can pin the person. So it's kind of this interesting idea of another take on this competition scene. I think the rule set is really what defines a how a sport works. We technically say that judo, jiu-jitsu, wrestling are all the same sport, really, in terms of the art. Like the techniques are supposed to be all in the same world. You know, nothing says that jiu-jitsu has to be on the ground. You know, the judo techniques are all part of jiu-jitsu, but really the reason jiu-jitsu is practiced the way it is and judo is practiced the way it is, I don't know if I'm making generalizations, but it feels like because of the sport aspect.
Because of the rule set.
Because of the rule set, and it helps define it. So I'm curious to see what kind of, you know, when the rules say any submission goes, you know, neck cranks, anything, banana split, whatever you want to do. And I've been trying to actually roll with people this week and keeping attention to how often people go on their back, which is something that in catch wrestling, you lose by going on your back. You know, so you can't pull the traditional sort of full, like, De La Riva guard, where you're flat on your back. You can kind of play an aggressive butterfly guard where your back is off the ground, but you can't play the regular kind of guard.
But the shoulders have to touch the mat, right? So as long as you keep your spine curled.
Yes. So I'm sure there's, like, a set of techniques. The thing is, the catch wrestling is not this art form that's practiced widely. It's something that a lot of people in jiu-jitsu forums, I think, admire as an art form, but there's not, like, catch wrestling schools all over the place. There's maybe, yeah, I don't know, like, 5 or 10 in the United States is what it feels like. But there's not an organized system where, like, there's not a catch wrestling... Saulo Ribeiro with his jiu-jitsu university, there's not a catch wrestling university.
Yeah, it seems like there's a couple of, like people who are sort of big names in catch wrestling, like Josh Barnett, Eric Paulson, guys like that, that sort of, I guess most people, a lot of people look to for, like, as, like, the leaders of the catch wrestling movement, right. I guess, but it doesn't seem like there's as organized a body of, like, teaching and information. And I mean, there's actually a good forum called lockflow.com, which has some interesting stuff about catch wrestling.
Catch wrestling?
So, yeah.
I mean, I'm actually almost curious to see if it's a real thing or if it's a concept that kind of people talk about. Like, what I mean by real thing is there's somebody who says what I... Like, a regular, like a blue belt, who says, what I'm training in is catch wrestling. I just don't know how many... You know, I know there's high-level guys, like you said, like Eric Paulson, that say they're catch wrestling. But to me, that almost sounds like they're saying, I'm a jiu-jitsu guy who doesn't do any of that pussy Barimbolo shit. That's what always comes off to me as. But it's also, I see it as an opportunity to do something different, you know, and it's kind of cool and interesting to try.
Yeah, it sounds like you'll have fun with it.
Yeah, if nothing gets broken off or and the other interesting thing about it is it's submission only 12 minutes matches, but there's actually like
three, unless you get pinned, right?
I don't know why I keep saying submission only. I just have this feeling that pins are hard to get, but maybe not. So I have
submission mostly. Yeah,
and sometimes pins sounds a lot, you know, less badass, but.
Catches Lex can,
but probably not. But there's the three. There's three actual matches within one match, so it's actually a 36-minute match.
Oh, that's cool.
So like,
that's a long match.
Yeah. Well, if nothing happens, right? So if you lose the first round, it's win best 2 of 3. So you have to go again against the same guy. And I'm curious to see what happens and if I'm still alive and you know.
You're gonna make it, Lex.
I'll tweet from the hospital.
I've had that Salt and Pepper song "Push It" stuck in my head for like 3 days now. That's like, I just started thinking that I wanted to like start humming it into the microphone, but I restrained myself.
Actually, when we roll, a lot of times some weird song will come on and it'll get stuck in my head. Like that song, I don't even know what it is. "You're the Best Around."
Oh yeah, from Karate Kid.
Yes, that was stuck in my head for like months. So I'm finally.
At least your shit's motivational, though. Come on,
push it.
Yeah, what am I doing? What's wrong with me?
You know, Angie actually posted on Facebook. I saw a question about dieting and stuff and seeing what works. And Dean Karnazes talks a lot about that. I mean, this guy like eats pizza and
while he's running.
Yeah. So, his basic philosophy is something he says a lot is listen to everyone but follow no one, and
run 130 miles. You don't have shit to worry about.
Yeah, you don't have shit to worry about it. But I think if you learn anything from this guy, it's really like you should explore. You should explore what your body can do. You should explore what works for you. What makes you happy? Because what he landed on in terms of diet is he's big on. This sounds dirty, but nut butters. So is any kind of like I guess there's besides peanut butter, there's other butters.
Yeah, almond butter's good. Butter. Cashew butter is terrific.
Yeah. So
a little bit of honey in there.
Yeah, but see, I can do that because it's so fucking delicious. Like, I would just eat the whole. It's the same with ice cream. I mean, ice cream and peanut butter is just, you can't.
Oh, I know, man. Angie, when she used to get these big bags of cashews all the time, and she'd make cashew butter out of it in these, like, you know those giant wonton soup containers, like the big ones?
Yeah.
And I would eat a whole one of those in 2 days, and I would do it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't stop myself, so she had to stop making it, because I'm just ridiculous. I'm like a child.
That's my solution to a lot of dieting issues is like, as opposed to controlling myself, I'll stop the source. I'll like not get whatever I was eating a lot of before.
Don't let them get their grips, Lex.
Yeah, don't let them get the grips. So basically, don't deal with your problems. Run from your problems.
Yeah. Yeah, so run from your problems. Don't let them get their grips. And run for 130 miles if you want to cut weight.
These are all very practical, good and healthy advice.
So, you gotta read that article on Facebook from WingsDailyNews.com about flow rolling. Our very own Marco Perazzo posted it earlier today, aka the professor. And in the article, Marco didn't write it; another gentleman wrote it, and he talks about how he doesn't really see the point in flow rolling and he doesn't understand why people do it. I don't want to go too in-depth about what his opinions are because, A, I'm kind of brain dead right now and I don't want to misrepresent his ideas. But if you go to wingsdailynews.com, you'll see the article. And that's definitely an interesting thing, like whether or not, like what do you think about flow rolling? Do you think flow rolling is bullshit or do you think that it's something that people should do or...
I think the word flow rolling is too touchy of a subject. It's like, I feel like for a lot of people, flow rolling is something that's...
Do you bro roll?
Bro.
Do you flow roll, bro?
I'm not a big fan of saying, hey, man, do you want a flow roll?
Hey, let us flow roll.
Yes, let it, you know, frolic down the, you know, the path together holding hands.
You can feel when somebody wants to flow roll, though. It's like an unspoken communication.
Yes, I
think
so.
Slap hands, and then you're, you know, like you grip the person. You can kind of feel like, all right, they're not resisting that much. Let's just kind of move around a little bit.
Right.
And then sometimes it picks up. And
yeah,
sometimes it stays the same.
Yep. As gay as it sounds, you're like playing jazz together.
Yeah, you know? Duets. It's like duets. Mick Jagger and the fuck's her name? It wasn't Aretha Franklin. Nah, I don't know what I'm talking about. I was just thinking about a famous duet.
One of those like sexy big ladies with a lot of soul, Aretha.
But yeah, I guess that's a good analogy. Like playing. I mean, I don't know much about music, but yeah, I mean, playing jazz with somebody, or you know, I don't know, people dancing together.
Yeah, and some people
it's
just
cooperative.
Like, just like, you know, death metal together.
Yeah, yeah. It's like
I don't know if you can improvise death metal, but they're basically screaming to a lot of heavy shit.
Yeah, I'm sure there's people that get together and do that.
And,
yeah.
That's probably what catch wrestling is, the equivalent of
jazz wrestling. It's grapple duets. Salt and pepper's here and we are in effect.
Well, we're going to have to have that song take us out for the night. wait, how did the lyrics go?
I just know Salt and Pepper's here. Wait, now Angie knows it. She was saying it the other day. I know Push It Real Good is one part of it. That's really all I know. I don't know the lyrics. I just get it stuck in my head.
So that there you have it, folks. The one thing to take away from this podcast today is good advice from the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, Josh Vogel. Is push it real good. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Lex. All right, see you guys.